you're about to make a trade. Which you do you listen to? Is it, get optioning those options? Or let's do a little research. Learn more at finra.org/tradesmart.
Marshall's buyers are hustling hard to get amazing new gifts into stores, right up to the last minute. Like a designer perfume for that friend who never RSVP'd. Wishlist topping toys for her kids who came too. Mm-hmm. Belgian chocolates for the neighbor. A cozy scarf for your boss. And a wool jacket for your husband that you definitely did not almost forget. Marshalls. We get the deals. You get the good stuff. Even at the last minute. Whew. Find a Marshalls near you.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox. Welcome to the award-winning FCPA Compliance Report, the oldest podcast in compliance. Today, I begin a special four-part series of webinars I did with representatives from Diligent. These webinars are a great way for us to end 2025 and look into 2026. Over this four-part series, we'll look at due diligence, FCPA, export control, and sanctions under the Trump administration. I know you will get a lot out of this four-part podcast series in December, so I hope you'll listen to the entire series. Today, I'm joined by my good friend and colleague, Christy Grant Hart, as we take a look at FCPA into 2026 and beyond. Each of these podcasts come in at just under an hour. I'm Fox, and I'd like to welcome you to our continuing series of Diligent webinars where we're looking at compliance down the road in 2026. Today is reinventing how compliance is done in 2026 and beyond. I'm absolutely thrilled to be visiting with my good friend and award-winning podcast co-host, Christy Grant Hart. Christy, welcome.
Hi, Tom. This is so exciting for me. I love getting to talk to you.
So we are going to really take some time to look at not so much where we have come in 2026, but we really want to look down the road. And I have articulated that I think compliance in 2025 has been at an inflection point. And part of that inflection point is from the administration, who has changed their focus, certainly on the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and how it's been interpreted and how it will be used, or rather enforced, going forward. But clearly, the focus on trade sanctions, economic sanctions, foreign human trafficking and modern slavery, and the major designation of cartels to foreign terrorist organizations has really changed the focus of not simply the administration, but also what compliance has and what it will mean going forward. One of the things that has struck me is that here in 2025, we are talking about third-party due diligence as important as any other part of your compliance program. We've been having that discussion for the last 25 years, but particularly with the designation of cartels as foreign terrorist organizations, it's not really changed the focus of due diligence, or rather the definition of due diligence. It's changed the broadened out who you have performed due diligence upon. And this speed of change will no doubt continue under the Trump administration. And whether or not you have a robust FCPA enforcement strategy, or at least a traditional FCPA enforcement strategy, we still have a wide variety of foreign laws around anti-corruption, anti-bribery that are being aggressively enforced. And one of the things that has intrigued me the most is the B2B requirement for a robust compliance solution, meaning if you want to do business with a customer or a company, you may have to have a compliance program. If you want to access the cash that's what's in your business, either through a bank loan, through a private equity investment, a stock sale, or even an insurance policy to manage your risk, you have to have a robust compliance program. So I think all of those things are really at a part of or leading this inflection point that we're at. And I know I went through a lot there, Christy, but where do you think we might be at in 2025? Are we at an inflection point?
Oh, absolutely. We're at an inflection point in so many different ways. We're at an inflection point when it comes to particularly AI and AI governance structures, AI usage, all the privacy concerns that come with it. I think we've heard a lot about data analytics in the last update from the DOJ to the Evaluation of Corporate Compliance Programs guidance. They really added in the section about data privacy, about data analytics, and about AI. But I think this is the first year. Last year, I feel like that was a discussion in September when the update came out. But now I feel like there's reality to it in a way that wasn't just theoretical when it was put out. So I think that's a major inflection point. And I know we're going to talk about the places I see the most inflection, which is, I agree with you, Tom, in this third-party due diligence world. I was sharing with you previously that typically we at Spark Compliance, which is now a Diligent brand, are looking at a couple of third-party programs every year, putting in one or two. Right now, I'm doing three, which, you know, over the course of 1 month, I'm doing three more. And that really is a focus that so many companies are having, partially because of new technology integrations, but also because of new OFAC requirements, looking at just a much stronger view and more business-to-business review. And the other inflection point I think we're not quite at, but 26 is going to make the difference, is with modern slavery and forced labor laws really shifting and having serious consequences that I continue to believe people aren't paying enough attention to, that really will shape a lot of what 26 looks like and beyond.
Christy, I've also heard you talk about a more unified approach for compliance. So do you see the need to sort of put together these disparate areas, or what used to be disparate areas, such as the human trafficking, modern slavery, the change in designation from cartels to foreign terrorist organizations, the economic sanctions, the tariffs, the trade sanctions? Is this something that you really feel like compliance needs to have a much more, if not unified approach, at least a unified strategy?
Absolutely. They're all entwined. I think we used to think of regulatory areas as segregated and other ideas, right? So frequently, modern slavery might live in a corporate social responsibility program. We might have antitrust in squarely in the legal purview. The due diligence platforms only looked at anti-bribery. Some of them also had sanctions integrated, but a lot of the corporations that provide due diligence simply are still sanctions review only. And that just isn't viable. The pace is too quickly. It's moving too fast. And as AI comes in, we're seeing more and more capabilities for solutions to absolutely need to talk to each other. And the idea, it was always strange to me. We know we create training here at Spark that has more than one compliance area in each module. And it confuses people sometimes because they say, no, I just want anti-bribery. To me, it's okay. Have you ever read a bribery case? They don't just live with bribery. There is also usually fraud involved somewhere. And there's often conflicts of interest. And there are, you know, the real world is much more complicated than a singular training idea. So I think that as the real world cases never just focus on one thing, neither should we. It has to be an integrated approach, especially when it comes to third-party due diligence, that adverse media is a powerful ally for compliance officers. And one of the algorithms done well is going to pull up modern slavery and fraud and bribery and antitrust and all of the things, data privacy, data breaches that concern people. So I think this is a real inflection point where it has to be seen as a singular program looking at many different aspects of risk.
So for all of our listeners today, if you have a question, go ahead and put it in the question function. We'd love to take the questions as they come up. So we're not going to hold them till the end. And we'd like everyone to feel like, or rather, if they put their question in the chat function, then we'll be able to jump on it immediately and we'll know where we were in our presentation. If you have any questions, we'd love to have a great dialogue with you. Next, I want to turn to something that I think I misnamed, but, and maybe Christy, this is part of how you and Spark, a Diligent company, and indeed Diligent, are looking to move compliance to the speed of business. Could I ask you to introduce the Compliance and Ethics Innovation Collective?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a brand new program that Spark and Diligent have put together where we have an annual risk assessment tool that we help you use along with 25 hours of consulting and access to all of our benchmarking tools and white papers and all the things I've been creating over the last 10 years where you'll have that personalized response and a risk assessment that lives in real time with a dashboard that you can see updated. In year two, we have a compliance maturity assessment that you'll be doing, again, with all of this consulting time. And we also help put together your three-year roadmap in order to know where exactly your compliance program is going and should go. So it's a huge jump in terms of the integration of the different diligent risk modeling tools and maturity modeling tools with the personalized attention that Spark can give you. So it is really exciting to us to integrate the services with software, and that's what we're going to be doing next. So if you're interested in joining the collective before the end of the year, we've got excellent pricing. So give me a shout out. I'm at kgranthart@diligent.com.
And Christy, that your remarks really lead into three questions I wanted to pose to you. And they're here up on the screen. And the first one, though, is around your use of the term risk management. And why do you think we need to talk about risk management as opposed to something we may have talked about in the past few years, which, of course, was compliance? Why or how do all of these disparate topics, ideas, and concepts come together within the broader framework of risk management? And how does the collective really help a compliance professional get their arms around them?
Tom, I get frustrated sometimes when we look at enterprise risk management, which is its own beast, right? We have expectations from the Department of Justice and from OFAC specifically, and the UK Ministry of Defense, when they are talking about what they expect from a risk assessment. Enterprise risk is important, but everyone I've ever seen has compliance as one tiny box, if it even makes it into the ERM high risk or in the risk registry at all. And we, I think, as compliance officers, I've read in recent statistics that only between half and one and two thirds of compliance officers even have a risk assessment. Most of them aren't up to date if they do. And the last part of it is there is even statistics that show that they do the risk assessment and it doesn't inform the program or where it's going. So this makes zero sense to me. And I think that more and more companies are saying, we have enterprise risk. Why do we need a compliance risk assessment? And my answer is the DOJ, the UK, the SFO, OFAC. There are all these places where, you know, even the new UK laws about tax evasion and fraud require that there are specific risk assessments done for these. If you look at the data privacy laws out of the UK and the EU, there's a requirement to do, you know, transfer impact assessment, which is a type of risk assessment. So we can't rely on our friends in ERM to do this for us at the depth that a regulator would expect. And more importantly, in a way that informs our program with the depth that we need. So I think that risk management, we have to know what we manage from a risk perspective in the compliance and ethics world. We have to have real handle on where in the business that risk lives. We have to have proper mitigation plans to manage that. And we have to have real-time data in how our risks are shifting over time based on regulatory guidance, based on enforcement, based on our business prerogatives changing, new mergers and acquisitions, new territories we're going into. So to me, the risk assessment is so absolutely critical. I'm currently doing six of them from our consulting perspective, my team. And I think that the companies are still recognizing the need for this information. So it's just everything to me. It's where everything should start. It should inform your training program, your communications, all the things, policies, where you're focusing development. So risk management is absolutely critical, and we need to work with our friends in ERM, but it's not a substitution, and I will stand on my soapbox all day long about that because it's so important.
Christy, let me go down to the third bullet point, because we talked about sort of, I use the word chaotic, but dynamic, changing, transformative. There's a variety of words we could use in 2025, and we talked about sort of the disparate types of issues that a compliance officer should face. And would it be fair to say that we learned that we need a truly integrated approach to risk going forward?
Yes. I also will say, Tom, at the beginning of the year, you know, I tend to, despite all my positivity, there's a very cynical side to me about why and how compliance programs get invested in. And I would have told you between February and about August that those people who said their compliance program isn't changing based on the chaos and shifting winds, that they were wrong. But actually, as we come to the end of the year, I think that the biggest lesson we've had is that we really do have resiliency and a need for us. We are continuing, like Spark Compliance just hired two more consultants because we're growing so fast, which shows that companies really are still investing in compliance. There is pressure from Europe. There's pressure from other countries. The changing sanctions have meant that a lot of companies and their boards and leaders have said, compliance, help. How do we deal with this? So rather than simply saying, I don't need to worry about this, you know, FCPA has gone away in real terms for most companies, or at least the risk in the short term, there is a resiliency in our profession that I'm quite proud of and excited by. And I think a global perspective that does require risk integration, not just from the compliance program itself, but also from having this global view of a dynamic world, that kind of chaos and geopolitical strain and shift needs real-time responses.
And then now let me go to the second bullet point, because one of the things I've tried to articulate that compliance needs to move at the speed of business. And if you, as your compliance function, can take the tools and wrap them in a way that allows the business to move quickly and respond to the business pivots or the business changes or the business transformations, could that really help build a trust between compliance and business that we may not have seen previously?
Absolutely. I think that we're getting so much better tools. So I was in London at the Diligent Compliance offsite 2 weeks ago, looking at the cool stuff that's coming out. And things like the ability to answer third-party due diligence questionnaires much more quickly because AI has access to all your policies, your code of conduct, your SOPs. If we can do things like answer those questions quickly, this is amazing, because we're not saying it'll be 2 weeks or 3 weeks until we get the reports. We've got immediate AI summaries of what is happening with that company and initial views, which doesn't replace all the due diligence requirements. I'm not saying that. But if you think about the opportunity to be immediately and dynamically responding to sanctions changes and being able to talk about them, being able to fill out those questionnaires really much more quickly and being able to get through vendor processes faster, we're also seeing, you know, the development of APIs, which allow systems to talk to each other in many different ways. We are becoming more dynamic with our tools, which I think does engender trust, which is, you know, your question about engendering trust. The more that we show we're using the tools available to us to make the business processes move faster and manage risk more quickly and easily in a sophisticated way, that creates trust that we genuinely are partners in a way I don't think we could have been seen before. It's an exciting and dynamic time because of that. Even asking me where you see this going, where do you see this going in 26? What do you think is going to be our talking point next November about what happened and where we had the most change?
I think it's going to be three. And I say that because, as you know, I wrote a book earlier this year, Upping Your Game, about using AI and other cutting edge tech in your compliance program. But the more I look at how we could use tech, the more I see a services-based component to that. We talk about the human in the loop, but the tech solution is only going to give us the raw information. It's not going to analyze the information, and it's not going to tell us what the solution is. So the compliance professional who can look at the solution and either say up or down, yes or no, but probably more importantly, we've got a risk here. It's a new risk, or it's a different risk for us. How do we manage that risk? And that's where someone like you, Christy, will come in and say, we'll manage this risk based upon some prior examples of similar risk, but not the same, and we'll use the new tools available to us. So that's really what I see. I started off the year thinking it was going to be tech, but the more we do it, I think it is a combined solution.
Yeah, one of the things I'm always talking about here is, you know, when regulations change, there is a desire to have, you know, AI create your program updates. And for me, the regulation gives you the outline of what needs to be done, but you have to adapt it to your company. There's always going to be different. If you're a startup in the food industry versus being a giant manufacturing company, there's huge differences in how you're going to need to implement the legal requirements of that new law. So I think that there's always a need to have that technology that works with the either services industry or internally to make sure that those requirements really make sense where you are and at your business.
All right. Can we pull up the results? And there we are. Tech-based solution, 9%. A different direction, 27%. Wow, nearly a third may go in a different direction, but clearly the majority are thinking integrated compliance solution going forward. So some very interesting results there. Let me see if I can get us back. Here we are. All right. Let's talk, Christy, for a few minutes about the FCPA. And I think the Trump administration has changed the game around FCPA, but we've both been in this profession or in this focus of our professional life for a long time. And we've seen various administrations come in with different focuses. Is this focus of this administration by combining anti-corruption, anti-bribery, as seen in the FCPA with other areas such as tariffs, such as economic sanctions, such as designation of foreign terrorist organizations, is that just a new focus, or is that something really different in your mind? And I'm going to leave monitors out of that now because I'm going to ask you some specific questions about no monitors and what that means for the compliance professional. But do you see a real change in FCPA, or do you see really a different focus from this administration?
So, Tom, I think this is such an interesting question. As I was researching, you and I do a podcast. For anyone else who doesn't know yet, we do Two Gurus Talk Compliance. It's so much fun. We're recording tomorrow for next week. And I was looking at this, like, what's happened since the decree? So in February 2025, we had the pause, the six-month pause on FCPA enforcement, the redo of what we're going to focus on. In June, we got the updated guidance that was really focused around FCPA is going to be looking at transnational criminal organizations or TCOs. We're going to be looking at anything that affects U.S. national security. We're also going to be looking as a Department of Justice at the anything that disenfranchises essentially or puts American businesses at a disadvantage, and then not looking at what they call smaller bribes. But the first and only enforcement action that I'm aware of or could find is from August. So that's 2 months later. And it was dealing with bribes in Mexico that had a little bit of potential ties to the cartels. But the focus was on standard bribery of luxury gifts to Pemex, which is the Mexican Oil Association, the government owned one. And it was $150,000 and included luxury gifts. So to me, that is a normal FCPA investigation and penalty. So I think that there is an interesting disconnect with that, but maybe it's actually all connected, that when we talk about these different priorities, maybe they're really not that different in practice. But I think the biggest one is the assumption, the declination, that if you self-report and you have a good compliance program, there's some criteria around this, but if you do all the things they want, you will get a declination. That is pretty game-changing. And I think compliance officers can use that to say, look, we're not even talking about presumptions or hope. We're talking about declination. So we need this program to be killing it right now. And in case we have a problem, we're able to respond easily to this, right? So we're seeing, I think, more and more, if you look at what the UK has done with the UK Bribery Act and now the tax and fraud laws, what you're seeing is presumptions of declination or, you know, rebuttable presumptions that happen with good programs. The antitrust world, I think it was last year, Tom, decided that a good program was now a defense. So we're seeing this as a trend and one I think will continue that really benefits compliance officers in how they are approaching these regulatory sentiments.
So let me go down to the third point, and that is the no monitors. The Trump administration has made clear they are not interested in monitorships for corporations going forward, either with a declination, an NPA, or a DPA. And there was a lot of conversation about this, but in, I think it was Todd Blanche, but it may have been someone else from the Department of Justice, they gave sort of their theory behind it. And Christy, I want to maybe say a few words about that because I thought it was very interesting. He basically said, we're not in the business of having companies improve their compliance program. We are enforcers and we will enforce the law. We will leave it to you to put Mr. or Mrs. Compliance Professional or Mr. or Mrs. Company to put together a best practices compliance program so that to prevent an incident from happening again. And we will not put a monitorship in place now. However, if you do become a recidivist and you do violate the FCPA a second time, we will bring the hammer down on you. And I thought about that a lot. And I don't know if you, I'm sure you remember David Green, who had the, headed the SFO yep. in the last part or last decade of the century. And he was very clear. This was not the serious champagne office. We weren't going to look at small, excessive expenditures in gifts, travel, and entertainment. We're going to look at serious cases. And we're not going to tell you how to put together a best practices compliance program. We're going to enforce the law. And he said it, and I don't recall him getting near as much commentary as the Department of Justice here in the United States has received from this. So once again, we have a different focus by this administration. But I say all that as an introduction to ask you, Christy, does that put more pressure on a compliance officer and a compliance program should you find yourself having gone through the process, whether that's a declination NPA or a DPA, to get it right so that you do not become a recidivist and really incur the wrath of the Department of Justice?
Oh, man. You know how I feel about monitors, Tom. I was on two corporate monitorships. I did Siemens and I did DePue, which is a Johnson & Johnson subsidiary, when I was in practice at Gibson Dunn before I went in-house. I think that there can be very effective. And I think the threat of monitors and the, frankly, documented huge costs of them can be really beneficial to a compliance program. I actually think this is quite a loss to pull away from this. However, since we in the compliance profession have zero capability of telling the government what to do, I think that honestly, your better bet is to say, we need a great program in place now to try to avoid these kind of problems happening and to get those declinations if we did have them. But I suppose if you're in one of those corporations, there is pressure to keep it right, but apologies, more often than not, I've seen companies go, oh God, that's over, whew, and then just move on and not put as much effort into their compliance program, which is, I think, why we see so many recidivists. We really do. And, you know, those are hard places to work.
All right. So let's move to this. If you don't know Christy, I will tell you she's a very passionate woman. One of her top passions is in the area of human trafficking and modern slavery. And this is one of the areas that I think will have the biggest change, or that may not be correct, it will have more focus. And so, Christy, I really wanted to turn over to you where you see we are today with human trafficking and modern slavery and where you may think we're going down the road. And then I'm going to have maybe some either specific questions or observations for you.
I think this is such an important question people aren't asking. There was this big moment in 2015 when the UK Modern Slavery Act came out where companies went, oh, shoot, I got to make these statements. It was very broad, right? 36 million pounds of global turnover and selling in the UK or a nexus to the UK. That was a lot of companies. But then they quickly realized that, okay, the only thing that'll happen to me is either I'll be named and shamed by the newspaper for not putting one out, or the state can ask me to. Truly, there's nothing there, right? So everyone got pretty lax about it. And you know, Canada came out this past year saying, look, we're serious about this. If you have real violations, then it's $250,000 Canadian. Okay, that's a little bit of teeth, but most companies go, all right, whatever. Then we get the UFLPA, right? The Uyghur Forced Labor Protection Act. And if you haven't been to the Customs and Border Patrol website where they show in real time all of the blocked goods, the number that have been stopped and the number that have been destroyed, essentially, never allowed to come into the country, you will see that it's in the billions. Last time I checked, it was about $3.7 billion worth of materials that there's a presumption that they're made with forced labor. And there's a number of goods and services that frequently come into that, like cotton. 25% of the world's cotton production is out of the Xinjiang region where the Uyghurs live. So that's really difficult to manage. Where did all of your cotton material come from when it's mixed in bales with, you know, Ukrainian and other places of where they grow cotton? But what to me is really interesting, so you've got UFLPA, but then the Senate committee last year, there was a hearing where people are saying, listen carefully, they are now moving the Uyghurs to other parts of China. And, you know, the U.S. can use this as a very strong business lever to say, if these people are being moved to other regions, we can do more sanctioning, we can stop more products, we can do a lot of different economic harms. And of course, with the Trump administration's America First, this is a very convenient place to create more trade war and to create more problems for companies when they're importing goods from China. And we're also seeing what I think is no one's paying enough attention to is the European Forced Labor Act that's coming in that will have a presumption that goods, any good made with forced labor, it's a rebuttable presumption, but they won't be allowed in the largest economic bloc in the world. So when you start to see that's the punishment is you can't sell into Europe. Oh my word. Most companies not being able to sell their stuff into Europe is a big freaking deal. And it's not just the end product. It is the supply chain that creates that risk. So you've got the United States with UFLPA, you've got Canada, you've got Australia, and you've got the US and California with the transparency statements, but we're suddenly seeing real economic problems with no, you can't bring your things here into America or into the European bloc. America has had a lot of pressure on the EU to try to get them to make blanket statements, for instance, like anything from Xinjiang should be considered forced labor. Europe has pretty forcibly said that's not the direction we're going to go. But either way, you end up massive economic sanctions that are going to push companies to look more closely at their supply chain because they don't want these consequences of massive market disruption for their product.
So, Christy, one of the things that interests me about this arena and this area is that if we tie it to this larger global economic trade sanctions, tariffs, and other sanctions that the government has put forward, that this could be an incredibly important part of the government's response if we do end up in a larger trade war with China. And they'll be looking to American companies for 100% compliance. And so should American companies be preparing for such an eventuality now? And if so, what are some of the things they could do?
I don't think I can scream yes loudly enough without hurting everyone's ears. So yes, we are on notice, people, that this is all in place or coming. And when you look at how the geopolitical situation is working out, I think there is it's an inevitability that we are going to have to focus on this. And also, it makes people feel good, right? Most of us don't want our clothing made by people who are in slavery conditions in Bangladesh, right? Or our shoes being put together in ways that we wouldn't want to be around. So there's a combination of reasons this is so important. And I think in terms of due diligence programs, I still see so many of them that don't even have adverse media either turned on or the vendor they're using, they're not capable of doing adverse media review. It's hard to find modern slavery. It is. It's hidden. And there are so many ways to do this. So the first one is if you're an American company, Tom, the number of risk assessments I've done recently that people say, oh, we don't need that as part of a category. Yes, you do. And sometimes in the reports that I write, I say, who are your janitors? Who is your short-term labor? Who is your contract labor? Oh, we've known them for years. This is America. We're not high risk. And it makes me insane. Number one, you need to get educated about where modern slavery lives, both in the United States and globally. You need to have third-party due diligence with adverse media. And you need, if you are in a high-risk area or manufacturing anywhere in your supply chain, I think on-site audits are critical. And even then you miss things, right? The New York Times did an expose, I believe it was in one of the car companies in the South, where they had kids working overnight when the auditors weren't around, but it was found eventually. Luxury goods brands in Italy bringing in Chinese workers to work, you know, 16 hours a day in the back of the factory, where you think these are luxury brands. There's no way they're made with modern slavery. They're made in Italy. They do, in fact, have this. So as you can tell, I'm very passionate about this, but it is really an area that has much more critical economic risk as opposed to simply reputational risk than it ever has before. And so it's time to get ahead of this. It's time to start having those auditing programs. It's time to include modern slavery risk in your risk assessment. It's time to expect other companies to be asking you those questions. So now is the time to prepare, so you have systems in place that you're not frantically responding to. If you flip a expands, you already know that you've got your supply chain reviews under control and that you feel confident that you can answer questions from the companies buying from you.
All right. Now I'd like to
I get off my soapbox now, Tom? Is that enough?
I don't know. You may just beginning to get going after I ramp up here on the FCPA cartels and FTOs.
Yep.
This to me is one of the biggest changes for U.S. companies. So I live in the great state of Texas. We were a part of Mexico before we became a nation. Mexico's always been our largest trading partner. Texas companies do business with and in Mexico as a part of routine business. Now, the cartels in Mexico have been redesignated as foreign terrorist organizations. And when you think of foreign terrorists, you might think of Al-Qaeda, you might think of ISIS, or groups that had an ideological difference with the United States that made them want to destroy us. These are entities which are not ideologically based, they're transaction based, and cartels are some of the largest businesses in Mexico. And so we have put a ideologically based nomenclature of a foreign terrorist organization on a transaction-based organization, the cartels. Now, what does that mean? It means that cartels are about doing business and making money as opposed to wreaking destruction, as was or as is ISIS and Al-Qaeda. Well, now we have this incredibly powerful tool, and that's the FTO, or foreign terrorist organization designation. And any touch point you might have with anyone doing business with a cartel could potentially put you directly in the Department of Justice's or the U.S. government's target sites. And this, I think, has led to and will lead to not a redefinition of what a third party is, but a completely new set of third parties you have to do due diligence on. So say you're doing business in Mexico and you open a bank account at a local Mexican bank so that you can pay either employees, you can pay suppliers, you can pay those you're doing business with in pesos. And how much due diligence would you have done on that bank before January 21 of 2025? You probably checked to make sure that they weren't money launderers or on a money laundering list or on a special designated entity list. Now you have to do full due diligence on them. You're not going to be able to look at who are their customers or who has bank accounts there, but you're going to have to take a deep dive into who's their ownership. What's their ownership structure? Do they have any beneficial owners who are not identified? Are there any shell corporations or other corporations that have ownership interests that might be shell corporations? Have you looked at their compliance programs? Have you evaluated whether or not they have an AML program or other compliance program that's significant? Will they agree to your compliance terms and conditions? Will they engage in compliance or an AML training? All of the things you would think about with a third party, particularly on the sales side of your business, you now have to think about for a whole new series or a whole new category of third parties. This, to me, is incredibly significant. It's going to put a lot more pressure on U.S. companies to perform due diligence, because remember, if you do business with an FTO, it's strict liability. The government can come in immediately based on that action alone, whether you were negligent, whether you were not negligent. It is a level of responsibility that we don't see typically in the FCPA or other types of criminal jurisdiction or investigations, I should say. And Mexico, remember, is just the start. The U.S. government has already started designating cartels into Central America. Well, you can clearly see the next step where Trump is going with all of this. Venezuela is completely isolated now, but Colombia, Ecuador, and as they move south and given the relations with Brazil, it could be a designation of criminal gangs in Brazil. How do you begin to assess all of those business relationships if you're a major U.S. company or even if you're selling in to those countries? So I think it's a huge change. And when you couple it with FCPA, it could bring, and I don't want to say renaissance, but literally an explosion of compliance cases with a little bit different focus. So, Christy, that's my high horse. What is your high horse? Or do you think it's different than my analysis, at least to this point?
I think that the immediate response from the compliance community was, I don't do business with cartels. This isn't a big deal for me. Without a lot of understanding of how sophisticated the business structure is of like the Sinaloa gang, that's one of the specific named ones. I'm in the great state of California, where we also were part of Mexico for a good long time and have very strong trading relationships about 2 hours south from where I live in Orange County. And I think that there is a misunderstanding or apprehension within our community still and the compliance community about how exposed companies may be to these risks and how strongly we need to focus on that ultimate beneficial ownership when it comes to any kind of Mexican or, frankly, a Central American partner. I know, Tom, you probably paid attention with a little bit of shock that the president of Colombia and his family have been designated by OFAC as specially designated nationals for drug issues. And so when you see that kind of pressure happening in other parts of the world, and we see such a focus on Mexico, South and South America happening, that we in the compliance community need to be on alert that these are places where the government is likely to focus. I think I agree with you tremendously in terms of compliance program response. We work with several manufacturers that have maquiladoras, which is basically manufacturing across the Mexican border with powerful tax incentives. That the ones we work with are in Texas. So exactly what you're describing, the back and forth of goods along the border. Now, who's doing your security? How are in Mexico? Who is helping you with the logistics? Who are these companies? How are they owned? And a lot of times, like on the borders, that's where you get a lot of the gang activity. So if you are exposed in those ways, it's incredibly important to be doing that due diligence and also to up your schedule of renewal for those to the best we can do in terms of automatic monitoring, making sure that no one's on the sanctions list, but just being really aware that this has become a high risk area. If you haven't updated your risk assessment for Mexico and what your exposure is within Central America, I think that is something you should do as soon as we finish talking here because it's so critical.
Could you maybe say a few words about the governance part of all we've been talking about?
I think we're seeing more and more integrated committees. If you're doing AI, it's almost certain that you're a part of the governance structure that is going to be an integration between compliance, security, technology, and perhaps other procurement maybe that are involved in that. The governance of all of this is very important. I continue to see that boards don't have good oversight here. There is very strong statements within the evaluation of corporate compliance programs that these organizations are required to have understanding of the culture within the company and understanding of risk and risk management. So I think we need to continue to educate the boards to the best of our capacity and to have governance structures in place that really monitor risk appropriately and are horizon seeking for where those risks are coming next so that we can be responding in real time now to what's coming in the future.
Trade sanctions, 6%. Economic sanctions against FTO, 0%. A convincing
people
management.
Are not worried about that. I'm not sure they're right, but they're not worried about it. Okay.
Continued investment in compliance, just under half. And then as exactly what you were talking about, Christy, governance and oversight structures. Very interesting responses. All right. So, Christy, I want to ask you to maybe put on your Karnak the Magnificent hat or turban, as that case may be. And let's spend a few minutes as we move towards the end talking about being ready for change. We've talked about a lot of change. We've talked about a lot of things we think needs to be done. But one thing I wanted to maybe step back a little bit and not really overwhelm the CCO, the compliance professional. And what's a step that they could take today to help modernizing? Or maybe the flip side of that is, what should they do if they begin to feel overwhelmed?
So in terms of modernization, one of the things that I see frequently is that people don't know how to use the tools that they already have purchased to the best of their capacities. So two things I would say: get together with the either salesperson or your customer person and say, what kind of reporting is available? And also, what is the product roadmap for the next year? Because when we know what's going to happen with our technology, we can plan to make it work better for us. So no matter what solutions you have, being able to know how to use them more effectively. We come in frequently and people say, this tool doesn't work. And the answer is typically, no, it's just not set up well for you, or you're not using it to the best of its ability. So I think there's a lot to say about using what you've got and understanding where it's going to use it more effectively in the future. There's so much innovation happening both at Diligent and in the compliance world in general that knowing what that looks like is very powerful. And in terms of overwhelm, back to your risk assessment, it's very overwhelming to look at every type of possible risk in the world. And if you're trying to respond to everything, you're responding to nothing as effectively as it needs to be responded to. So I always say, yes, you could do 45 things. And right now people are doing their 2026 planning. The clients we're helping frequently want to do too much. And I appreciate and respect that. But you can only get so much done in a year, and you have to build in time, or should, for investigations you don't even know about yet, for fires that are going to be put out, for, God, your goods getting stuck at the border because of the EU Forced Labor Act. And one of the most important things is really to build that defensible case around your risk assessment to focus on what matters most to your company. I think that is the easiest way to deal with overwhelm, to say what matters today and what's going to matter January 1st and June 1st of 26. Focus on those things now.
Richie, I want to start with some remarks on the final bullet, which is the one area of your program most ready for reinvention. And I'm going to suggest that our listeners think about a innovative solution like the Compliance and Ethics Innovation Collective. And I say that because it combines both the technological solutions and innovations of Diligent, but also with literally one of the top services components professionals in compliance. But you guys have packaged it in a way that will allow a compliance program to respond literally throughout the year to any changes. So I'm going to suggest that the part of the program ready for reinvention may be the ability to follow these transformations, to follow these administrative changes when the administration moves in a different direction than either we anticipated or, you know, President Trump wakes up and says, I'm going to punish Canada because they played a Ronald Reagan commercial. The compliance profession needs to be ready to move. And I see the CNE Innovation Collective as a service offering which allows them to do that. What are your thoughts?
It's a mix of technology and services, which is what the majority of our watchers want. It's getting that risk assessment that can be updated in real time with dashboarding, along with the kind of expertise where you say, heck, what do I do now about this Canada issue? What do I do about Colombia? What do I do to update my risk assessment based on what's happening within my company? So I think when you're looking for change and understanding where it's going to come, that helps you to respond to the business more effectively as well, having expertise, having technologies that support it, and being able to show value that you're really on top of it. I think a lot of compliance officers, frankly, the biggest emotional challenge is always feeling behind. And we really want to make sure that you don't, and that you're able to have the best tools at your disposal between consulting, technology, benchmarking, and tools, that you're really able to respond to these things effectively. And that's why I put this together, because honestly, I wanted to be, when I was a chief compliance officer, I would love Compliance and Ethics Innovation Collective, where we share best practices, understand what's going on, and are able to, with technology, respond to the challenges we're seeing. I'm excited about it. I really am.
We're moving towards the end of our hour. I wanted to encourage anyone, if they have any questions, to please put them in the chat functions. But what I would like to sort of re-emphasize from this event is that compliance really needs to be able to move at the speed of business, but think about the management of risk, not simply compliance, that you will have to manage a wide variety of risks. We talked about FCPA being at the crossroads, but I think we both feel like FCPA is still alive. It's still going forward. It will go forward with a little bit different focus in the United States, but Christy made very clear that international anti-corruption, anti-bribery initiatives and laws and regulations are still being enforced robustly and will be. With the modern slavery and human trafficking, you saw the Chinese, or you see the Chinese response to take Uyghurs and move them out of Xinjiang. The Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act doesn't say clothing only from Xinjiang. It's those made with forced labor. And so if China diffuses their forced labor, how are you going to protect yourself from that? I see the FCPA, cartels, and foreign terrorist organizations as a very large new area that companies are going to have to look at from the transactional basis, and then being ready for change. Christy, we've had a question come in, and let me just read it to you. What is your opinion on modern slavery in the context of AI and its potential aversive impact? Should companies assess AI providers on their practices to exclude forced labor?
I've never thought of this question before, so I'm thinking about it on the fly. Technology companies tend to be very low risk. I guess the question would be, what kind of AI are you describing? Are you concerned about the algorithms or the models that either can consider exclusion of risk or not paying attention to it? That's one place that you're going to be finding this. AI summaries, especially of due diligence reports, are looking at adverse media, whether or not they're going to be reliable. I think that is one big question. Technology companies typically are very low risk for modern slavery, unless you're talking about developers in third countries, but even then they tend to be relatively, you know, paid. So I think that AI and modern slavery, I think honestly, are very unrelated, at least at this point. But I think the AI can be used to help you to suss out where modern slavery might exist. And certainly a well-trained model, if you ask it, if, you know, this third party is in this industry in these countries, it should be able to tell you where those risks lie. And if you don't know, you can look at the transparency statements that the U.S. puts out, the TIP report every year. You can also look at Amnesty International. There are other companies that put out reports every year about what's happening with modern slavery, what industries, and where. So there's a lot of resources out there to learn from, but I think AI just makes it faster and easier for us to be able to do those evaluations in a risk-based approach.
So the recording will be made available to all attendees, as will the slide deck. Diligent will let us know when those are available. On behalf of Christy and our entire team here at Diligent, I wanted to thank you for attending this event. And we've got one last question, which is, if you'd like to find out any more information on navigating the DOJ's latest guidance, or really any of the topics we've touched on, you can go ahead and let us know. And Diligent, someone from Diligent would be more than happy to chat with you. Christy, any final reflections?
Compliance isn't going anywhere. It's not. And I'm really happy about that. I think I and a lot of compliance professionals felt pretty down in the spring that maybe this was going to be a real problem for us. And I will say that now I don't feel that way. I feel very excited about where we're going. I'm super excited watching the AI tools and what they're going to help us to do even better. But ultimately, we are really important. Regulation is not getting lighter, and that it is our responsibility to do the best job we can, because ultimately, what I always come down to is compliance is changing the world because of how business is done, and we're critical for that.
I wanted to thank everyone for attending. We're just coming up to the top of the hour, and we look forward to visiting with you again on our next. The FCPA Compliance Report is the longest running podcast in compliance, having been founded in 2012. Finally, I hope you'll check out my latest podcast, AI Today in 5, where I look at 5 stories of AI and compliance literally every day of the week. I know you'll enjoy this new podcast. I hope you will join us again next week, where I will be joined by Stephanie Font to take a look at the expansion of due diligence to a new category of parties through export controls and sanctions and the redesignation of cartels as foreign terrorist organizations.
Join Vanguard for a moment of meditation. Take a deep breath. Picture yourself reaching your financial goals. Feel that freedom. Visit vanguard.com/investinginyou to learn more. All investing is subject to risk.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.